19, Cougar Biology Overview. This is a briefing. And Rich, the floor is yours, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, good morning. Just take a second and apologize that my color scheme's a little bit different. I made a couple of last-minute changes last night and didn't realize we were standardizing those. But before I begin, I just want to say thank you because you requested this research update, and we've learned quite a bit with cougars. We've got a pretty good body of knowledge and a lot of products that we're excited to share, and we're happy to be a part of the process. So on behalf of really all the research team, which I'll introduce here shortly, want to let you know that we appreciate it. Okay, so we'll just jump right into it. Just an overview of the presentation today and talk a little bit about the history of management, some research topics over the past 15 years. Again, those products that I had mentioned in our new management structure. Just a couple of quick notes about interagency data comparison issues and little report card on our overview of the past four seasons under this new structure. So as you may or may not know, 1966 was when we started protecting cougars as a big game species. A few years later, we started this mandatory reporting program. And so basically any cougar that gets killed on the landscape, we know about it, we're able to collect information from it. That began in 1970. Then for about a decade, we had close to about a 70-day general hunting season. That happened until the mid-1980s. Just around that time, we started collecting teeth from all the mortalities. That allows us to send those teeth off to a lab. They get cut, stained, put on a glass slide, and aged. It's not as precise as bears because they have that cycle of going to sleep and coming out, and the rings between, just like rings on a tree, are pretty obvious. It's not that way with cougars, but it's pretty good within a year or two, and long-term data sets mean a lot. Following 86 and for the next decade, we actually had a slightly lower season. It was a 60-day permit-only hunting season. Then in 1996, of course, the initiative came along where voters banned the use of hounds to hunt cougars. For the next decade, we had a 227-day hunting season. And then 4 years after the initiative, the legislator approved hunting with hounds by permit only. And that continued all the way through 2011. In 2003, we started collecting DNA from all mortalities. Part of that was due to a large DNA project that we had going. I'll explain that here shortly, but now we collect them from DNA from all mortalities. We learned quite a bit from that. In 2004, we started the Cougar Hotline so hunters could report. We started harvest guidelines so they can call the hotline, find out what's open, what's closed. That's pretty standard operating procedure for cougar management. And then from 2009 to 2014, we had a 212-day general hunting season, and then just this past year we added the month of April, and so we now have a 242-day hunting season. So there's an overview of cougar management, pretty quick, but for the past 50 years. So the cougar, it's a cat known by many names. Cougars, mountain lions, pumas, catamounts, panthers, ghost cat. It's all the same cat. And that scientific name that you see there, puma concolor, it really means a cat of one color. So they're born with spots, those spots turn to bars, and eventually they go to this uniform coat color. And I always like to ask, this is one of the slides I put in with school kids, and ask members of the audience how old or big they think that cat is, and I get a lot of different answers, but that right there is a 110-pound, one-year-old cat. So cougars display what's called sexual dimorphism, meaning the males get, one sex gets bigger than the other, and in this case it's the male. So in Washington, 120 to 190 pounds, but really the adult average for most hunters, probably 90%, 140 pounds is about right. And for females, 82 when they're just about to give birth, they might be 120 pounds, and an adult average overall is about 90 pounds. One thing I'd like to just inform everybody about is just the challenges of cougar research. There's some images here. You know, they climb trees. So when you shoot your mobilization dart, you'll see on the top right there, 75% of the time, you've got to go get it. So you got to be pretty good with climbing and ropes and safety gear, and it's challenging. And that lower left there, that's a net that we put up at the bottom to catch it in case it falls or in case I fall. And if you're lucky enough, there's a bottom right picture there, but just to give you a little bit of appreciation for it, so we ran the Okanagan Project for about 10 years and had four really well-trained houndsmen working on that project. One of them's a retired smoke jumper who's also a cattleman. Two of them are a father-son team who own a business in Omak. And the third was a business owner out of Winthrop. And just really great guys. It was their backyard. They knew everything. And so all five of us would go out 4 months a year, every single day of the year, on snowmobile in the backcountry, on average putting on about 50 miles apiece a day. And if we were lucky, and after 10 years, our average was about one capture every 10 days. So that's, 50 man days and 2,500 miles driven per capture. So a low-density carnivore for sure. These are some of the research topics that we have covered over the 15 years. Lots and lots of neat stuff. Talking about a lot of this today, social organization, abundance and density and growth rates. We were the first state in the country to do the biopsy dart technique. One of our hound handlers, Miss Bobby Thornley, is back there. Don't let her size fool you. She's about as tough as they come. She was one of about 15 hound handlers that were involved in this project, but overall about 100 folks from Washington were involved. We're going to talk about source sink management, using DNA to evaluate field ID. Older age structure and territoriality is a big topic today. And then all those topics there on the right, and that bottom right, some staff response guidelines. We've just put together a lot of charts from this information, how to sex a cat, how to age it, things you should know when you're responding to incidents. We've given our staff quite a bit of tools. There's no Bible on any of this by any means, but we think we've made them better prepared to be out there in a lot of situations. And then, of course, our scientific peer-reviewed publications. These are 15. It's grown since then. We're probably 23 now. Lots and lots of information. I don't think for a long time that the work that's been done here in Washington is going to be repeated. It's very expensive work. We've been lucky. We've had support from the commission and from the agency, and the university's being involved. This has been something pretty special. So, moving into using behavior for management. It's not a new idea, albeit this is a different application. This is Temple Grandin. Cargill is a cattle company, been raising cattle since 1865. After 126 years, this woman came along and she approached him with an idea. Use cattle's behavior for management. And in Cargill's words, she revolutionized the industry. She was thinking outside the box. She made the whole operation safer for cattle, safer for people, and she improved the quality of the meat just by taking into consideration cattle's behavior. On the other hand, with WDFW managing cougars for 47 years, now we're using cougar behavior to improve management and preserve social stability, which we're going to talk about quite a bit today. So in my opinion, like Cargill, Washington's leading the way rather than following. Here's our cougar research project areas. I'll go through those with you. This is the Selkirk study area that started all the research here in Washington. This is the Wedge in Ferry County and around Kettle Falls. This was the DNA project area that I spoke of in Ferry and Okanagan counties. This was the Okanagan project in the Methow Valley up towards Loop Loop Summit. This was the Blue Mountains in Columbia and Garfield counties. This is the Kittitas County project around the Clay Elum area. And this was the West Side project in King County. We pulled all of these projects together, but we reached out also, I wanted to let you know, to the Native American community. They're doing some research. This is where the Macaw Reservation is. They actually had some cougar research that they collaborated with us on, and we used their densities in our estimates. We know the Quinaults have done some cougar research, but they just didn't have a lot of captures and a lot of data to share, but wanted you to know we spoke with them. Of course, the Skokomish, again, several years of research, but just not a lot of captures. It's pretty tough country to work in. And then also the Muckleshoots that I didn't want to cloud this up. They have some research, but didn't want to share with us to include in our density estimates, and that was okay. So we got a pretty good representation there of all the research that's gone on throughout the state over the past 15 years. And this is just a wrap-up of some of the number of years for each of these projects, 58 total years of research, the number of cougars that were captured, and again, little star here showing you, I'm not showing you multiple captures of the same individual. That number would rise pretty dramatically, but those were the number of captures for each of those. And again, here's the size of the study areas, totaling 17,500 square kilometers of Washington. So probably about almost a quarter of the total amount of cougar habitat has had research in it. One of the products that came out of the research was this new statewide habitat assessment. It looks somewhat similar to things that we've showed in the past. This used to be a big black hole, and when with GPS collars and looking at habitat types used using GIS, we're able to highlight a little more, with a little more clarity, some of these habitats that cougars are using. So down in these drainages, these ghastly looking little patches here, that's all cougar habitat. And so we've included all of that in our new statewide habitat estimate.
Yes.
Is that presence absence or territory?
That is presence absence. I'm going to discuss that. Great question. Another product we've been able to do, because we looked at it by GMU, going through and seeing how much habitat exists there, what our average density is, we're able to look at habitat population estimates for cougars by GMU. So another tool for our staff to answer questions. We pull these into districts and into PMUs, which I'll discuss here shortly, but this is another product. If you've been around for a while or looked at our past research, you know that we used to manage based on these zones and pretty large geographic areas. We used to have 13 of them. They were comprised of multiple game management units, this one being the smallest, all the way up to one of the biggest that had 22 GMUs. And they were just basic geographic boundaries. Not much thought into this. It was more just grouping what seemed to make sense to us and how we were going to go about management. Since 2012, and wrapping up a lot of this research, we've designed this new PMU management structure where we've created 50 PMUs. And they're made up of 1 to 4 GMUs, and they're all roughly about 1,000 square kilometers. We know the game management units were developed around deer herds, so that made a little bit more sense to come down in size, but There were a lot of considerations that went into this, including habitat, the density of cougars, the harvest history, human access, where can they make a lot of kills, where can't they, and people, all considered when creating these boundaries. We sent some of their first draft of these out to our regional staff. They helped us fine-tune them based on their local knowledge of the landscape. Sometimes we group GMUs that we didn't think to do off the bat that made more sense in the end. And so really this was a statewide effort pulling this together. So with our previous zones, this was the one I had pointed out, which was the smallest of the three zones. We had some issues with harvest clumping that concerned us. This was the harvest in 2011-2012. Plotted on the landscape, and you can see when this zone closed, this region here took a lot of the availability of the hunting, and these folks here were pretty upset. They, you know, this is their backyard. They were hoping to get out there and hunt, but this closed, and this giant geographic area closed, and they had to go elsewhere. But there were some other issues too. I mean, this is high access. This is where people are able to drive their trucks in for most of the winter on a lot of these roads, get a snowmobile in, just lots of trail systems going through there. And so we wound up with this inequitable harvest, or harvest clumping is what I'm calling it. When you have these clusters, that results in a breakdown of social stability within the cougar population. And then when you have these widespread closures, there's a lot of hunter frustration. I mean, like I said, 100 hound hunters involved in the DNA project. A lot of them are my friends, including Bobby here today. I heard from folks. They called me all the time. I knew that this was an issue, and I knew there had to be a better way. So with this new PMU, we're thinking about not only social stability, but equity across the landscape. So the following year, this is what the harvest looked like. All these three were actually broken up into separate units. So if this wound up closing, all you had to do was cross the highway and go into the other GMU. And I got a lot of positive response from hunters on this. So again, there was less harvest clusters. Less clusters preserved our territoriality, which we'll talk quite a bit about. And then these smaller closures resulted in considerable hunter satisfaction. Some benefits of these PMUs. I think for hunters, an older aged animal on the landscape is a better quality hunt. The harvest is fair and equitable across the landscape. The hunters aren't negatively affected by these large closures. They can hunt next door. They don't want to have to drive 2 or 3 hours to a spot if they only have an afternoon, or the snow just fell and there's a nice 2-inch layer and they're able to do tracking. They want to hunt close. They want to be able to jump in the rig and head out. For non-consumptive users, well, it recognizes their values by maintaining the integrity and social structure of ecosystems. And for managers, for us, it's simple for people to understand. It's inexpensive to implement. It's scientific and defensible. And it satisfies our agency and multi-stakeholder interests. So a little bit about the PMU closure process. I mean, as you know, there's no closure regardless of harvest prior to January 1. When January 1 kicks in, we tally the harvest once a week. If it's reached the limit, we give 2 to 3 days notice, and then the zone closes. We have this is off of our website, but the same information is also on our telephone hotline. Just explaining to folks about the harvest guidelines, some things to know, the numbers to call, the website to check. And again, only hunter kills apply towards the guidelines. So there's other mortality. None of that figures into this closure process. A little bit about the terms here. We've chosen to use the term guideline rather than quotas or limits. I just think a quota really connotes a target, or rather than a threshold. a limit out there really has the connotation that, oh, we cannot go over that number, rather than it being a guideline. And of the 13 western states that manage cougars, 92% of them use these harvest guidelines. All of them have a mandatory inspection and sealing protocol, and 85% of them use this telephone reporting information hotline. And all of them but Washington have a 24-hour closure notice, so they just get on the phone, update it as closed on a Friday, and come Saturday morning, you need to check the hotline and see if it's open or closed. A little bit about the 12 to 16% harvest guideline. There was, I think, a little bit of confusion with this concept. In the literature, you might have seen some of this high versus low harvest areas, how female and male harvest percentages play into that, adult versus sub-adult harvest percentages. The high versus low harvest manuscript, really what they showed us is the two ends of the spectrum. One was low, everything was okay. One was high, everything was in chaos. So what we needed to do was find the sweet spot in the middle. We knew it was in the middle, we just didn't know where. In both those study areas, in others as well, when hunting and territorial effects were removed, we discovered that the intrinsic growth rate of a cougar population in Washington was 14%. Plus or minus 2, so 12 to 16%. That's where that number came from. It's if you took away all the hunting and territorial effects, which we'll talk a lot about here, that's the rate at which a cougar population could grow in Washington. So the rate of growth equals the rate at which it would increase with none of these things happening. And if the mortality is greater than a growth rate, that results in population decline. That's where these terms high versus low come from. There really doesn't designate anything other than that.
Excuse me, Rich.
I'm sorry to disrupt, but I have to ask about that idea that this 14% applies no matter what the habitat condition is in, the changes going on. So
right.
I just am uncomfortable with the idea that nature has one number.
Okay. I appreciate it. I've got a couple slides coming up that I think will talk about that a little bit, but territoriality plays a lot into this. So I hope we'll get to that point here momentarily. Appreciate the question, and Commissioner Wecker. So this 12 to 16%, all age and sex classes are treated the same with the intent of preserving social structure and replacement, and kittens are not included in this. Each sex and age class, whether it's a one-year-old, a two-year-old, or a three-year-old, they all contribute to this population structure. So if you have higher removals of one age class, it's carried into the next. So think about waves coming onto a beach. If the three-year-olds are missing or they're really low, eventually they're going to show up, and we're not going to have that adult population to take over. The PMUs that we've designed have resulted in a really well-mixed sex and age class in the harvest. Right now it's about 60-40 skewed towards adults, and it's 50-50 on sex ratio. So we don't need, because of the size of these PMUs, we don't need female-based subquotas, which a lot of agencies use. Those are difficult to administer. So this strategy is based on equilibrium, harvesting at or below. And just a note, if we harvest below, that doesn't mean that the population is going to increase. And that's due to territoriality, which I'm going to get into. So three additional studies have validated the 12 to 16% growth since we published that in 2013. The following year in 2014, Robinson out of Montana, they showed a 12% growth rate. Logan et al. In 2015 in Colorado documented a decreased population at a 15.5% harvest rate. They backed it off to 11 to 12, and everything stabilized. And then recently, myself and a couple other folks with the DNA Project, again, Bobby's probably new here to Bobby too. This is a brand new, it's in press right now. decreasing population in Northeast Washington at an average of 14% harvest rate. So over this 10-year period, we harvested some years at 7%, some years at 21%, all years combined at average 14%, and that number had a decreasing trend throughout the study. So a lot of these harvest rates are tied to weather. As you know, cougar hunting is all about weather. You get a good snow year, you can take a lot of cats. You don't, you may not take a lot. And again, it's important to note that only hunting mortality applies towards this guideline. We record everything, don't get me wrong, it just doesn't apply.
So when you say hunting mortality, that's not a damage take. It's only
that's right.
Okay.
Yep, thank you. So this structure, it allows some district staff the flexibility to use either of those numbers when they tally up their harvest and make a decision on closure. So we give them this flexibility. An example of this is in Region 2, where we had the Carlton Complex fire, lost a lot of animals, as you know. The district biologist there decided this year he would go with 12%. Other years he's gone to 16%. So it gives them that on-the-ground flexibility to make these decisions. Okay, switching gears a little bit to talk about how cougars orient themselves on the landscape. This is real typical of a cougar study area. Average male home range size is about 140 square miles. Average female home range is about 50 square miles. And one thing we've seen over and over and over again is this configuration where it looks like puzzle pieces on the landscape. And this is how we, as researchers, go out. And if we're sitting and we see a hole right here, this is a different slide, but if we see a hole right here, we know we're missing something in there. We have to get in there and catch that cat. And so it takes you a couple years to get to this spot, but then a removal happens, and that's going to be replaced, and now we've got to get in there and mark that animal. And so it's pretty neat that you're able to do this. You can only do this with a couple of animals, and the cougar's one of them. So a little bit about their social structure. So this is a resident adult male's home range. Could be 150 square miles anywhere in Washington. He tends to overlap three females. And those three females, this may be a mother-daughter team. Every male that's born to these three females travels, on average, 120 straight-line distance miles away from where they're born, every one. A lot of the females go, but some stay, and they take up resident next to their mom. And they may overlap, so this is one of the unusual overlaps that you'll see in cougar home ranges. So like I said, they're producing offspring. Many, notice these are one-way arrows. Other cougars are producing kittens, and they're taking off. And notice these are two-way arrows. So sometimes they stop, sometimes they go in. They may challenge this animal. The winner takes all. Sometimes they come in and go, oh, there's somebody's marking here. I'm getting out before I get my butt kicked. So it takes cougar, 3 to 4 years to be able to put the mass on to even conduct territoriality. And this is what it looks like. This is the Kittitas Cougar Project area. You see this one spot where these two cougars overlapped, and this is what you tend to see. A fight to the finish. This wound up being the victor, but I'm not sure if he was really that much better off. That's the kind of stuff you see with territoriality. This is a home range. The point I'm trying to make here is to let you know two things. One is that cougars are border patrol agents. That's their job. Constantly. If they're not eating, making babies, they're on border patrol all the time. And their home ranges, when they tend to get killed, again, they're like puzzle pieces. A new one comes in, like this one did, and they occupy almost identically what that previous cougar did. And they're using ridge tops, roads, rivers. These are their natural home range boundaries. So they're very predictable in that manner. When you overlay those two, you see just how much of an overlap there was. And if you put one-way arrows on these, and our in-house GIS specialist has done that, you see this, up and down, left, right, up, down, up, up, go take a break, have something to eat, and then go back to Border Patrol. That is all they do. And unlike deer and elk that will scratch trees and let you know that they're there, and bears that may rub and leave a lot of piles around, this is the cougar's calling card. It's very, very nondescript. It's called a scrape. And they might just pull together a little bit of vegetation, pee on it, and that's their calling card. And other cougars on the outside are constantly watching, paying attention to that stuff. If that animal gets killed, that scent dissipates over time, and a new one moves in, and they know, oh, look at here. Nope, nothing's been here in a while. I might have something here. Maybe I can establish my own home range. So very, very nondescript calling cards. So just to drive this point home in how it relates to mortality, if this is a cougar study area in any one of the counties that anyone's from here, if you had these males defending home ranges, this was the population, and you harvested at a lower mortality rate, things remain relatively stable there. These home ranges fill in rather quickly, and there's not a lot of chaos socially on the landscape. If you harvest at a higher mortality, you see these little arrows. There might be a little bit of movement in between, but at the same time, here come the subadults, and they want to find out if there's anyone there. They're not defending home ranges because they're too small for a couple years. They can't. And so their home ranges are overlapping all the time. The density can be the same in these two scenarios. And it's not just hunter kills. Again, it's all kills that affect this structure. But if you live right there during one of these situations, you think the population's out of control because these subadults are not as good as navigating the matrix as an older animal is on the landscape. So, again, these two densities may be exactly the same, but all of our studies have shown adults do a much better job at navigating the landscape. So some effects of high harvest. Although these local sinks can be repopulated with immigration, high harvest can lead to breakdown of territoriality, increased home range size and overlap of these younger animals. This results in a perception that the population is on the rise. Some demographic changes that occur. You have younger age structure. You have reduced adult females because now they're the preferred take for hunters. And you have increased kitten mortality, which may also lead to decreased adult males because when the resident male leaves and a new male moves in, he's going to kill every kitten on the landscape that's not his. That's just how it works. And if she tries to defend him, she may lose her life as well. And we've had radio-collared females killed by radio-collared males. This is fairly common. So this may create unanticipated consequences, resulting in an increase in cougar-human interactions. Again, that all those overlapping home ranges that I told you, you can't really pin anything down on who does depredating when it does occur. They all do it, both sex and age classes. But they're like individuals. They're just like people. So we can't really say it's a certain age class. But because we know subadults will overlap people more, they're going to get sighted more, that's going to increase the number of complaints. Territoriality and density dependence. Because of territoriality, cougar populations are not analogous to muskrats. There's a ceiling to their growth potential. So in this example, I mean, elk would be the, you know, in a hunted situation, elk wouldn't do this. But in this scenario, let's just assume we took away all the people, all the hunting, all the concrete, gave them all the food that they could possibly eat. This is how deer and elk would grow. If we did the same thing with cougars and took away all the people, all the concrete, gave them all the food that they could eat, they would still grow like this. The number one cause, naturally, of death to cougars is other cougars. That's density dependence. That's why there is, well, ceiling to their growth. One of the things that we've encountered along the way is that Washington's density estimates don't jive with some other state. Why is that? There's a lot of reasons for it. This was a nationwide survey that we did back in 2009 asking agencies, how do you estimate your cougar populations? Well, a lot of them simply extrapolate harvest data, which has some issues. It's not the best, it's not the worst, but is the harvest representative of what's out there? I think even in ungulate studies we found it may or may not be true. 47% are using research. However, 40% are extrapolating, just looking at how much habitat do we have, what's the densities that we've seen in the literature, let's do the math, here's how many cougars we have. So one question we didn't ask, where's their overlap between these two, and are only 7% of the agencies doing long-term research? And I think that's probably pretty close. Some just flat out say they don't know the estimate. And then some do track transects, and there's a lot of problems with that because of, you know, one cougar can leave a track in mud, sand, snow, and it looks like three cougars when it's only one. Or you could put it in the snow, and after a day, it looks bigger. After 2 days, it looks bigger. And so track transects, there's a lot of problems with them. So what we need to do when we make these comparisons is standardize density estimation, and this is happening right now. There's a lot of folks doing that, and I'll show you that here in a minute. But basically, this is how you do it. You get GPS data locations. You create home ranges for all your females, and you create what's called this composite home range. That is your study area. You may have been looking for cougars out here, and this is your study area, but this may be a big wheat field. There might be a town right here. And so this isn't your study area. This is, you let the animals define it. So you calculate the female density, which may be 1.3 cougars for every 100 square kilometers. Then you overlay all the males on top of that. But an important point here is you have to give this male a 70%. You can't count him as a full cat because, look, he's outside the study area. This one may get a different number, 0.5. This one may get 0.8. This one may get 0.4. Yeah, that's how you have to group those together. You can't go 1, 2, 3, 4. A lot of people are doing that. But it's getting better. Then we know harvest occurs before we were able to capture an animal. We don't know if that animal occupied that home range, so we treat it like it did. And we give this female, if it's a female, the average of all the females, and this male the average of all the males, and we include him as a resident. These folks have done that, and not only that, but they took out all the noise with the kittens and kitten production, and these are the densities that came from long-term research projects. There's so many 1 year and 2 year. This is expensive research, and there's so many 1 and 2 year snapshots. If we take all those out, go with anything longer than 6, 7 years, look at the standardization of these density estimates across the West. It starts to make sense. Now, ours looks like it's the highest because we're using 18 months, and we state that up front. That's what we're calling an adult. May or may not be biologically, but when it comes to harvest, that's what we're talking about. So very consistent density, that's territoriality.
Rich, that's both gender?
That's everything, yes. Yep. And sub-adults, and anything over 2 year old. So some density and harvest rate take-home points. Anytime we discussed harvest rates, we need to know how the population was estimated, which was used to calculate that harvest rate. How was it obtained? Is it local, statewide, or extrapolated? These things make a big difference. The density needs to explicitly state whether it's based on the total population, including kittens, just everything greater than 1 year old, or everything greater than 18 months, or that fourth category, just 2 year olds. This is now becoming the norm. It hasn't always been the norm, which is why there's so much noise and what's going on. When harvest rates are applied, the same thing needs to happen. Did you apply that harvest rate to all the population? Just 1 year olds, just 18, just two. These, it seems like it makes perfect sense. It just has not been addressed. So you can't be Julia Child. You can't throw the harvest and density into a big bowl and stir it all up and throw out some density cookies. There's a lot more to it, and it needs a lot of explanation. Quick update on the hunt structure since 2012-13 season. You can see 70 to 84% of the time we have PMUs that remain open and still offer hunt opportunity. The distribution of harvest across the landscape is working. Areas where we typically had no or low harvest is starting to increase. At Region 4, for well over a decade, 2, 3, one time it was 4, so I had to put 2 to 4, but 2 or 3 in the entire region was very, very common. This year we had 19. I mean, it was a good snow year. That plays into it, don't get me wrong. But people are starting to see, oh, wow, you know what, Issaquah, we've got the same harvest rate as Northeast Washington. Wow, we've got cougars in Issaquah? Literally, we're getting these questions, our field staff are getting these questions. So people are realizing that they can hunt in Western Washington too. Seen an increase in Region 6 as well, but just a little update about how that's working. And as far as opportunity, you know, our harvest guideline statewide is 241. 12 to 16%, that's the numbers we're looking at. And since 1980, 241 or more has occurred only 4 times. So we don't think with this PMU structure we're taking away any opportunity. I think we're spreading it out and we're teaching people. There's a lot of other neat places to hunt. These are the harvest rates for the areas that closed by region. So these are only the PMUs that closed in the past 4 years. That's how they break out in the Northeast and the Blues and Kittitas and the Olympic Peninsula. And the only point I want to make here is you see the 14s and 16s, that's the percent harvest rate. That's where we're doing good. Some of these that get a little bit higher, that we just need to do better. It's our housekeeping. But look at 2015-16. We're getting better. This is starting to settle in now. It's too early to be really making a ton of judgments here, but we've gone over in some areas, and we need to, you know. Some of this is 50% of this, on average, is due to the January 1 start. Right at January 1, we wind up closing 4 or 5. And then the other 50% is just the lag time for the mailing, the reporting, the documentation, and then the implementation of closure.
Mr.
Yeah.
Something that's just, I had to get it answered. We've heard a lot of public present information and testimony, and you know, Jay Hosemiller down where he lives, and you know, everybody's seeing more cats. It's like cats are everywhere, and you know, you tend to believe those. They're good reports. If our numbers are working and we're in that 12 to 16% range in most cases, how does that jive? Because that, we should be seeing fewer cats if we're at the 12 to 16%, yet we're hearing so many reports of more and more cats.
Yeah, well, I think part of these, some of these numbers that you're seeing here that are a little bit high, that we're not doing what we're trying to do. We just need to do a little bit better. Statewide, complaints are decreasing. This past year we're at the lowest level of all time, and I know there's some issues there, and people don't want to call, or you know, they say they don't trust the department or the government. We just need to hear about those. We need to get out there and respond. We're here to help. We've got a whole list of ways that we can help them with those sightings, and so we're just request that they call. That's all I can about tell you.
For sure.
I guess the answer, because I looked at our area, we closed down 3 or 4 years.
Yep.
And West Ward would usually be 117. And they went over harvest and they closed down 4 years. And I guess, there again, this is my perception, and you're looking to raise how many mountain lions we can keep on the landscape, correct?
Looking to raise it?
Well, no, no. Your management goal is to fill up the landscape with cougars. And because you were just talking about a one Issaquah, we're getting mountain lions where we didn't before, right?
Well, I don't know if we're getting them where we didn't have them before. People are recognizing they've always been there.
But I mean,
I'm sorry. But I guess it's your perspective. Listening to you, the way you're managing mountain lions, you're trying to keep them at the optimum, maximum level where supposedly everything's sustainable in that, right?
We're trying to preserve social stability in the cougar population, right?
Right. And you're saying that they will self-limit because the males will kill and blah, blah, blah. So that's, and I think that's why you're seeing, because there again, with this management scenario, you're basically filling the landscape with mountain lions. What's quote unquote carrying capacity?
Yeah, I guess I look at those numbers a little longer, but you know, it would appear that where you exceed the 12 to 16% rate, you would see more cats. You'd have more reports of cats.
That's right. You'd have more subadults on the landscape that tend to overlap people more.
Yeah, according to all the research and what you're telling us, and I'm just looking at those to see if that's what's happening, I guess. And it takes a little while to study it and know more about it, but it seems that makes sense, and that is what's happening.
Yep. Well, this slide is in your packets. I'll just, in the interest of saving time, there is a little bit of uncertainty in our management that I just wanted to let you know about. There's tribal harvest that occurs not only on tribal land that we don't consider or count, but in our GMUs, there is harvest that's occurring that we don't include in our harvest guidelines. So there is undocumented harvest, and really it's region 1, 3, 4, and 6 where that may be occurring. We don't know the numbers.
Does that include illegal poaching non-tribal?
I'm talking tribal in this instance. Okay. Yeah, their take is not reported to us in a lot of cases. Again, that early hunt season has no guidelines, so these guidelines can be exceeded. And this habitat map, to speak to Commissioner Thorburn's question, we use the binary code. It is either 0 or 1. And so you know some of these neighborhoods here, it's probably not great cougar habitat, but we're counting it. That's where we got our numbers. So the density that we found in some research areas, it may not be representative. We tend to work in some of the highest quality habitats. These are tough animals to catch. Like I said, 1 every 10 days. We've got to be in the best of the best just to get the sample size to do anything. So here's an example of that cougar habitat. This is one of our study areas. This is what we said was cougar habitat. This is the study area, and you can see the green is the best study or habitat that the cougars used. That was applied to the rest of the PMU, and it's a model. It's predicted use, but is it the same on the outside? I don't know. But this is an issue that we'll look at here in the future. But as of right now, this is what we're going with. And this is what we have confidence in. I want to definitely thank the research team. Like I mentioned, it's a pretty outstanding group of folks. I want to thank the commission, the agency for doing the research, WSU, UW. Incredible collaboration with some pretty special folks. So that's to recognize the research team. And I hope that, I hope that the presentation, you're able to gain a little bit of appreciation for the species, a little bit of appreciation for territoriality. It's really, really complex stuff. And you might recognize this picture. This has been on WDFW's job applications, every one that's gone out for probably about the last 8 years. There's only a few animals that make it, and that picture made one. So appreciate your time, and thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Rich. Outstanding presentation.
Thank you.
Yesterday we were talking about deer harvest estimates and looking at how the unreported harvest is worked into that. So I was wondering, in terms of your density estimates, if there were some way that you could bring in those unreported harvests, like from the tribes in those regions, if there was some way that could be estimated or worked into the density. Yeah. Has that ever been thought about?
Yeah, Commissioner Thornburg, members of the commission, it's a great point. I mean, it's just an unknown, and we just don't like to work with data that's not solid. I can tell you that we'll be looking into it, and if there's a way that it can be estimated, we'll bring it to you to consider.
Mr. Keough.
Thanks, Rich. That was a very good presentation. So I'm a little bit out of my comfort zone here, but I'm going to go. Anyway, I have a question about the density dependence specifically how it relates to California. So my understanding is California, it's illegal to hunt cougars in California. Is that right?
Correct.
So, and then you see kind of anecdotally once in a while, you know, pictures of cougars in urban areas, particularly in Northern California. So, so you would think then in California, with no harvest, I mean, you would have, or legal harvest, you would have kind of this leveling out. Is that their experience down there, or are you familiar, or do they really do any similar work that we do here in Washington?
Yeah, I mean, I know that California is pretty mixed as far as habitat types. They have a lot of what we call sky islands, and so 60 Minutes just did a piece on them about how cougars are navigating these islands surrounded by highways, and it's different in Northern California. But it is important to know that California still has a lot of the same laws that we have where, you know, if you feel threatened, you can shoot on site. If you have an incident, they'll give you a permit or landowner permit or a depredation permit. And they wind up killing, you know, just over 100, maybe 120 cougars per year in that huge state. And so it's not untouched. But, you know, I think one thing that we can say here that we've seen is, in a lot of our research projects, when we go in, there's a stable age structure, there's an older age structure. I mean, when we did the Clay Ellen project, it didn't even hit the radar as far as complaints went because that was such an older age structure. Well, when we moved out and went on to other areas, folks started realizing, oh, heck, if we can hunt there, well, that's probably a pretty good spot. Heck, they did a research project. They went in, and you've seen harvest rise in Region 3, and now the complaints are really getting high again. And so I can't speak to California, but I can relate it back to here that, you know, when harvest is low, our complaints are low. When harvest is high, our complaints are higher.
Well, nope. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I could listen to you all day. This has really, really been interesting.
Thank you.
Complaints are higher. And yet there's a component of complaints, you know, can be, I saw a cat, can be a complaint.
Right.
But when you actually get down to a cat that's caused a problem, you know, taken an animal, charged a house, or, you know, some of those types of things, do you feel that with your experience with hounds and all the trapping and tracking and that you've done, that, you know, that seems like a very logical way to take care of problem cats, or, you know, as opposed to letting more hunters, you know, take out more animals that might even cause more problems, more of a surgical approach. Just wanted to see what you thought of that.
I Commissioner Keeney, I agree. I think we have a lot of tools at our disposal, and I think we're doing a good job. And this has been part of our management structure, which is to remove the offending animal. That's where we see the greatest value is. I don't think blanket control is the, with all the social effects that happen, is the best approach. And like I said, don't paint them with a brush. They're just like people, individuals. Sometimes the cost will outweigh the benefit, and sometimes the benefit will outweigh the cost, and we'll make a decision to go in and kill a goat. We have those tools. We have people on board that can handle it. We've got traps that we can use that everybody's trained in. We've got folks that run hounds that can help us. I agree, that's the best way, I think, to address the situation.
You know, I don't hear anything in your report that says don't hunt cougars, don't allow hunters to have an opportunity to hunt cougars. Just consider the number that you're taking.
Yes, sir.
Just a comment more than anything. Rich, yeah, thanks again. Obviously, I think Washington is probably leading the nation in the quality of the research that you're doing. And that's, I think, reflects primarily your dedication to being in the field. It takes a lot of time and effort. And I don't think a lot of other agencies have the personnel that have that level of dedication and reflects in the work that you've done. I also wanted to mention that not only has he done this great work in cougars, but also he's known as the bear man in our area, in Region 2. And he has done some excellent work for public education to have preventative measures to avoid conflicts with bears. And I've worked with Rich, and he has an amazing presentation that he's done that's not only entertaining, but very effective. And we just have an outstanding individual in the department. And I want to thank you.
Commissioner Keeney, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, this was a lot to digest. So thanks. Very good.
Should have seen the first version.
I wonder, you know, I've heard different things about this attribution of greater degree of conflict and complaints associated with the younger males. I think you said it's all based on individuals. So it's a little confusing to me. If it is the younger males that are causing, are you saying that it is the younger males?
What I'm saying is the younger males overlap people more, they get cited more, and so the complaints, the sighting, the phone calls can be tied to that. When it comes to an animal that makes a decision to take a livestock, that is, there is no sex or age class that you can assign to that.
Okay.
They all do it.
So I get a sense that the younger males might make mistakes vis-a-vis people more than the older ones?
Again, I'm not going to say tie it to it. It's just like you or I being relocated to Missoula to go work for that agency. We don't know where we're going. If I take Maple, does it take me out to Maine? And you take it to see.
Okay. So
that's what they're doing.
One thing that's always been a question for me is I know that our hunting is more opportunistic now. Boot hunters just can't chase and find cougars the way hound hunters used to be able to. So it's more you run into a cougar or it exposes itself to you is more than my understanding, because if a cougar wants to be hidden, you won't see it. So is it true that the higher percentage of the cougars taken in the opportunistic hunt are younger, stupider, just more naive?
No, I mean, like I said, the harvest is 60-40, skewed towards adults. And so it's just the fact of this new hunt season, the length of the opportunity, the fact that we've grouped the license with the big game package now, instead of, 500 people, we've got 56,000 carrying a license. So I think those are what are lending to this higher harvest that you're seeing.
Here I'm going to argue with a cougar expert. But as far as predation, Back in the days when we used to run sheep, it was the ones we really had trouble with were the really old ones. And you could about set your calendar to it. It always seemed like it was about August, September, when the fawns and the calves were starting to get fairly fleet of foot. But we ended up killing two booked lions that way too. And one of them didn't have any teeth in between its carnivores. And so that became a couple times we had mothers with young ones. But for the most part, where we really started went in, it was be in the fall. And it was the old slow ones. So that was my experience with mountain lions as far as predation.
Again, thank you. Very important.
Chairman, members of the commission, great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm going to take it home and read it, too. So, second time.